Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show. This is scan number 2835. That's 2835. We are the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. And what we do is, this is just one way that we serve the public by having this talk radio show. And we offer a platform for people to come on and tell their stories. And then that's on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And then on Tuesdays and Thursdays, we have our professionals that come on too, and most of them are survivors, okay? A lot of us are survivors, as simple as that. So this is good. And so we're trying to bring forth awareness to the public. We've already brought forth awareness, but we also want to give you tools, what to work with, so that if you do have an interest, and I'm going to read the mission statement, that you'll have something to work with. Because it is my opinion that it is going to take we, the survivors, to make the difference, okay, in child abuse. We can't stop it. That's not going to happen. But we can make a dent in the statistics of child abuse. That we can do. And it's by being proactive, okay. So first of all, I'll read the statement. It says, we have a singleness of purpose at NASCA to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so two different ways. Number one is educating the public, especially as related to getting society over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting the facts to show child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem. It affects everyone, and believe me, it does. Our kids who get in trouble, they end up in juvie. That's one way. Maybe they've run away from home. Some of them get pimped out on the street. I think that's enough right there. I could go on and on. Oh, we have our B&Es. We have all kinds of things. So you see, it does affect everyone. Number two, offering hope for healing through numerous paths and providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. Okay, so I am Carol Levine. I am Vice President of NASCA. And tonight we have Teresa Strong Myrick. Is that how you say your last name, Myrick?
It's Myrick.
Oh, Myrick. Okay. Sorry about that. I wasn't sure.
That's okay.
And she's from St. Petersburg, Florida, and she, too, is a survivor of violent sexual and emotional abuse. Now, I'm not going to tell her story. I have her bio in front of me. But what we do here at NASCA is we, you know, have the person, whoever the guest is going to be, start their story. And when we do have a panel, that's usually Monday through Thursday. Fridays, people just want to go or something like that, you know. You know, they want to sleep, whatever. And then sometimes we get a shock and we have maybe 8 or 10 people. That's kind of wild. But anyway, so you never know how it's going to be. So, but she's here tonight to tell her story. And then I will stop her maybe. I'll see something in her bio. And I'll ask her about it because maybe I need her to explain something. And then we ask about what she's doing today, okay? Because, you see, that gives people hope. We know this, Teresa. It gives them hope.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people get on the healing journey, and, you know, it's a wonderful thing to get on the healing journey. And we have a lot of men coming forward now. This is very good. And, they finally found their voice. The monsters are not always men. They can be women, too. I lived across the street from one. I know. I saw her. I watched her. Oh, my God. Called the cops on her, too. But anyway, okay, so, Teresa, why don't you start telling us your story? Go ahead.
Hi, well, thank you for having me on again. I appreciate being on here and having this opportunity to talk to people and share the hope, because that's what I hope to do. I'd like to start off just by saying that I've come a long way. I am a former police officer, victim advocate, child and family counselor. I'm currently a life coach, an author, and a speaker. But I'm also the same little girl who grew up in a home where I could count on domestic violence in my home every Friday night. It was such that I hated to come home. And those who are familiar can, you know, attest to this. I just had a sick feeling whenever it was time to leave school and come home, because we always had to walk on eggshells. We could not make my stepfather upset. We couldn't do anything to disturb his peace, because, you know, he would get angry and take it out on my mom or whatever. But I don't always remember the stories. I don't know what happened during the week, but I knew that every Friday when he got paid, he was in construction, so we would pay the guys and handle the money, me and my mom. And he would go out, have a few too many drinks, come in, and the fight would ensue. I never knew what happened, what started the fights, but I knew that that was going to be the day where me and my brother would be huddled up in the back room, listening to the thumps and the bumps and the cries of the next room, and not knowing what we were going to come out to. So, you know, a lot of people don't think of when they think of domestic violence, they don't often think of the kids who are listening in or witnessing or seeing that. But we were victims as well. And that had long-term effects on me. And that is just part of the story, because, you know, my mom eventually got enough nerve up and strength and power to leave him. And she did, and we were good for a good little while, and she met someone else. And unfortunately, he molested me for many years. And I told, you know, I was one of the ones who told and who wasn't quite believed. It wasn't that they didn't tell me that I was lying. They just told me I misunderstood.
I misunderstood
what was going on. He came into the room. Yeah, he came into the room one night and called himself tickling me. And he was tickling my private parts, my vagina. And I told my mom that. And I guess whatever story he told was much more believable than what I was saying. So there was that. So,
yeah. Oh, hold on a second. I just want you to know that Bill is here. Okay.
Oh, hey, Bill.
Hi, Bill.
Hey, Teresa. How are you doing?
I'm good. Hi. How are you?
I can't complain, but I hardly ever do.
Well, no one's going to listen anyway. That's what you usually say. You forgot that part.
No, I don't say that. I say I know things could be better, but they could also be a whole lot worse.
Absolutely.
Yes, that's what he says. I'm teasing. She's in the middle of telling her story, yes. And isn't that amazing how that can happen? It's so frustrating to a child when they finally build up the courage to tell, and then it's handled that way. And what you said before is so, so true. You know, you don't have to get hit, because when you're watching domestic violence, I didn't get hit. My brother got hit. You know, let me tell you something. What it does to a child, whether you're hit or you're not hit, is just, you know, devastating. Absolutely. These are the people that are supposed to love you. They're supposed to nurture you. And look how they're behaving. I get it. Okay,
right. In your home
there?
Is You know,
yeah,
just saying,
go ahead.
And your home is supposed to be a safe place too, as well.
I know. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So, so this other guy, and I like to say this because I know so many women will downgrade their what happened to them and say, oh, it wasn't that bad. So with him, what he would do was he would come home, come to our house when my mom wasn't there before she got home. He would turn on some music and he would ask to dance with me. So when he danced, it was always a slow song and he would grind on me. So that was his inappropriate touching. So it wasn't any penetration or anything, but it was just as devastating. And I know that a lot of women who were just, you know, who were not just, but who were groped or fondled, they think that it's not as bad, but it's still something we should not be going through at any, you know, at that age and not unwanted and not asked for.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. But you know what? Let me say something there, Teresa. I think it is as bad. I agree with everything you're saying, but I think it's just as bad. You know why? I mean, I had everything happen
right.
to me. But
I
think it's just as bad because that fear factor sets in.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know.
When someone's touching your private parts or grinding against you, like you were saying, and the other, you know, the tickling, no, I think it's just as bad. And I don't agree with women when they say, or men, I mean, you know, there's men and women, you know, pedophiles, we know this. But the point is that never goes away either because I remember all the times I was molested and I remember the times I was raped, and quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
One's as bad
as
the other. Go ahead. That's how I feel. Go ahead.
Yeah. Right, and I agree with you, but I know that we have the same residual effects. No matter how it was, because it was unwanted, it was inappropriate, it was against our will. So it has some of the same residual effects on us. So I guess that eventually stopped. And the other thing about that too is I was, you know, people would say that I was old enough to say to stop it because that happened while I was in middle school and while I was in high school. But it was one of those things where I wanted to protect my mom. I did not want to bring this forth. I did not want to upset her because she had gone through so much in her life. So I had taken on the role of protecting everyone around me and suffering in silence. So I allowed it. Well, I shouldn't say I allowed it, but it continued because I didn't believe that anyone would believe me anyway because no one had. So it was one of those situations where I knew it was wrong. I never felt that it was the right, that he was doing something that, you know how some people will say, I thought that's just how every family was. I didn't believe that, didn't feel that. I just knew it was wrong. But I decided that I was not going to say anything in protection of her, and I knew that I would be leaving the home and going off to college.
I hear you. A lot of
times
kids will, you know, they'll protect the mother or they'll protect the whole family because they don't want
right.
to have the family break up because of them. And then the shame and the blame gets put in the wrong place.
Yeah, we take
you know
all of it on. As victims, we take on the shame of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because we feel like let me talk about me. I felt like I was bad. Like something was wrong with me. Some of the things I did to cope with it was, you know, while it was happening, I would disassociate.
Mm-hmm.
I would, like, kind of feel as if I was floating above and seeing it from above, like I wasn't really there. I felt like I was too pretty, too cute, I had too much going on. I was attracting the wrong people. So I started to pick in my face and bring on the scars so that no one would be attracted to me. You know, just did a number of things to try to take the attention off of me so no one else would be attracted and do the same things to me.
Right.
Yeah.
That does happen, absolutely. And,
yeah.
I've seen people do that.
Yeah.
But when I was a kid, I would pull my own hair out, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it was like a nervous situation, but it was, I mean, I'd
mm-hmm.
have to say it came from nerves, but also, too, I didn't want to look good because didn't want other people putting their hands all over me either. So go ahead, I understand that, yeah. I get
yeah, it's just strange how we fault ourselves for other people's bad behaviors, and that happened for years, right? I punished myself for the bad behaviors of someone else. So I did go off to college. I left home, went off to college. He was still in my mom's life, but when I got off to school, it was different. It was different. I just took on this whole attitude of trying to hurt men and hurt other guys. So I felt as if I could date them and treat them badly and not get emotionally attached and all of that stuff. I guess I was really protecting myself. I was in just self-defense mode, just trying to protect my feelings and my emotions and not get too attached to anyone. And I didn't want them to know my whole story because at that point I had not told anyone any of this stuff. No one knew about the domestic violence, the sexual assault, nothing. No one knew anything about this stuff. But I got off to school. And what I have always been is someone who could give great advice. People always came to me for different things. So I found myself in the dorm rooms on Friday nights, just like now. And a number of girls would be in my room, and we just sit on the floor, and we talk about different issues. And I would be the one that people thought had all the answers. I had no idea why, but I was just good at it. So I decided to go into social work. I said, I'm going to change my major because I went in for business. I was like, you know, I'm going to change my major to social work because this comes naturally to me.
Right.
Little did I know that part of that whole program, like the fundamental part of the program, was to really get to know who you were before you could help other people. Mm-hmm. So I had to do this psychosocial assessment on myself, which means that I had to tell my story from birth till current, and that knocked me on my butt. I cried all the way through the process of doing all the way through the assignment, turned in the assignment, was crying. The professor was like, listen, you're going to have to take care of yourself. You have to get help before you can help others. And that's what started me on my counseling journey, on my healing journey.
Yeah.
That was the first time that was the first time I went to counseling, knew about counseling, and it made a tremendous difference for me.
That's good. I'm so glad you did that.
Do you mind if I go back a little bit to one of the topics you were talking about a few minutes ago? Because I don't want to, I mean, I had a thought, but I don't want to let it go. This is when you were talking about how you were telling people who didn't believe you or didn't
mm-hmm.
want to believe you and stuff. And what
mm-hmm.
I wanted to say about that is I have a suspicion that there's far more of that going on than we really believe. In other words, we think that the child ought to be, it's kind of coming from us. We think the child ought to be mature enough or old enough or smart enough to work out these things called prevention and intervention. And they're simply
mm-hmm.
not. You know, they are, they're not developed enough to even have those thoughts. So when you were talking about, you know, your thinking process when you were small, I was thinking mm-hmm. of this and I said, you know, I think an awful lot of us try reaching out, try to explain what's going on, try to get help, and when it falls on deaf ears, then it's an extra hurt. And of course, I went through that, and Carol knows, and Carol went through
mm-hmm.
it, and you did. So all three of us, you just talked about it. So all three of us, and I think there's much more of that than we know about, because it's not something we delve into a lot. We talk about the abuses itself, themselves, but mm-hmm. Not the other part. Anyway, thank you for letting me express that. I didn't want to lose the thought.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for jumping in there. And two, that's one of the reasons why I could not stay in, because I work for the state as a child protective counselor, and that was one of the reasons I could not stay in that, because, first of all, I hadn't gotten enough healing myself to deal with it, but it frustrated me to no end. It just bothered me so much when parents did not believe their children, and they believed not even the biological parent, but a boyfriend over their blood children. And that just bothered me so much. It caused me so much stress and anxiety, because
right.
I could not fathom, how would you believe this stranger, essentially, over your child? How is it that you're blaming your child, saying that she did something or he did something to deserve whatever this perpetrator did to them?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Teresa.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
It says here, my father was murdered by his best friend when I was about 2 years old, and he died in mom's arms. She subsequently got involved with my brother's father, who was abusive. Why don't you tell us about that?
So, my... And I've done so much, like, healing work on this, and I found, like, later on in life that I was blaming my father for all the things that happened because he wasn't there. My father was murdered when I was about 2 or 3 years old, and it was his best friend. So there was some kind of misunderstanding. They were having an argument about something, and prior to the argument, he had called my mom to come and pick up something for me. So they get into the argument. My dad thinks they're about to just have a fist fight. Did not know that his best friend had a razor in his hand. And he went to, I guess my dad thought he was about to punch him, and what he did was he had the razor in his finger and he slit his throat. My mom got there as he was dying, and he died in her arms. And actually that became the title of my first book, Attacked in Anger, Died in Love, because I told that story in such a horrific way for so long that in one of my coaching sessions, my coach, he gave me the assignment of finding something positive. And as you can imagine, I was like, what? Well, what are you talking about? How in the world? How in the world? But that was such a weight on me. It was such a weight on me. And what I came up with is that although he was attacked in anger, he died surrounded by my mom's love, because he could have died any other way. He could have been killed and dumped somewhere. He could have died in the alley by himself. But it just so happened she got there and he died in her arms. So and that just seemed to be like the story of my life, is that once I began to love myself and appreciate me for just who I am with all of my stories and all the things that happened to me, those things had less weight on me. You know, the burdens began to lift a bit, because I started to appreciate my story as just my story, nothing to be ashamed of, nothing that I can be blamed for. It was just part of who I was, and I was okay with it.
I can
think that that's what I'm saying is, when you're young, you can't get to that place. Don't get to that place.
Mm-mm.
You get it later.
No.
You know.
Absolutely.
And you realize, oh, it wasn't my fault. But it's definitely the child's fault from the child's perspective. And an embarrassment. And we're scared for ourselves and our family and our pets and all that, because we don't have control. And we feel we never will. But it's only later that we realize that, it wasn't just our fault. In fact, it wasn't at all our fault. It was our perpetrator's fault.
Right. And that's absolutely true, and I think that's why we have to choose healing. We just really have to be all about the business of healing because, you know, some people will stay there. Not everyone will choose to get healing, and they will stay there in that place of they will relive what happened to them, to them 30 years ago as if it's happening right now. So, you know, it's an ongoing journey, right? We're always filling that layers.
Right.
Well, yeah, a lot of times children, they blame themselves, you know, because they don't know any better. They don't realize it. They're just a kid, you know. They're just a kid. And all the things that you're talking about that you saw and that you learned about later on, too, I mean, there is no way that a child could stop any of that. You know, it's just awful what we go through. And sometimes the parents make you or they try to make you feel like it's your fault. You know, I've seen that happen in my own situations at times. And it's not true. Kids are just kids. That's all we are. And a lot of times we're victims. You bet.
Yeah, definitely, definitely, because we look to our adults to be the adults and to take care of these situations and take care of us and protect us. That's what they are to do, of course.
Absolutely. You said you were also a police officer, too, at one point?
Yes, I was a police officer as well. I was trying to do all the things to save the people, the young people like me. Yeah, so
I have to like police officers. Yeah, I like cops. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I was one of the, I was the cop who was running to the domestic violence calls because those are the ones. That's where I wanted to make the difference. And but what I learned is, as an officer, you can only do so much, right?
Yeah.
We can only do so much. And what people really need was a shift in who they were. Just taking away the perpetrator wasn't going to make it all go away. It stopped it
for
the moment, which was great, but it didn't stop the choices later on. It didn't stop her from choosing that guy again or another guy who's the same sort of guy, you know, over again.
That is so true, and I'm so glad you said it that way. Because I've actually said to people, I was never a police officer. I was an officer of the courts, and I had police officers that worked in the facility, detention. But, you know, we can only do so much, and then it goes to, like, CPS, you know, and you go before the judge, and it becomes a CPS issue and all these other kinds of things with the children. And, you know, they say, well, why couldn't the cops have done this, and why couldn't they have done that? Like you said, the hands are tied because we have, you know, you had certain things that you could do and other things, it goes to another division. That's just the way it is.
Right, and it doesn't stop what goes on in the home. It just doesn't. You know, it stops it for that moment, which is wonderful. We want to get the bad guys, of course. But when it comes to, like, shifting the whole family dynamic, it has to be more to it. It has to be more. You have to get to the core of what's going on inside that family and treat the entire family and not just remove one person, which is helpful, but it doesn't stop it.
See, we need people to hear this because we have those people out there that don't like police, you know. And you being an officer and then also my being around officers and there's things I could do and things I could do more, and then there was only so much they could do. They have to understand that, you know, we can only stop so much, and then it's all up to other organizations to get involved. That's just the way it is. And so often they don't do the right thing. And then they look back on the police officers, and it's not their fault. You know what I'm saying? It's really kind of frustrating.
Yeah, it can be frustrating. I mean, I always had a special place in my heart for women who were in domestic violence situations, because I knew, because I always felt like at some point they'll get it and they won't go back or they will leave. I always felt that they would. I never got discouraged with them going back to those relationships. just always had hope that they would eventually leave. But I also knew that once they left, they had to adopt a new mindset of how they went about relationships. Because if not, they would choose another guy who was the same, who was abusive as well.
Yep.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we're
so
like echoing
it takes
here.
More.
We did that. Bill and I are saying, that's right. That's right. It's the same time.
Yep.
Well, look. With all the training I had two abusive husbands, you know, because of the past. See, like what you just said, it didn't teach me anything. Not at that point. I
mm-hmm.
had to be done with it. I had to be done with it. You see,
mm-hmm.
and so when police officers are called, I want to make this clear, because when police officers are called to domestic violence situations, they don't know what they're coming upon.
No.
The people may very well be armed, okay? They
mm-hmm.
could have guns or knives or whatever. And
mm-hmm.
it's a very dangerous job. It's a very dangerous situation to be put in.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it. So,
yeah.
You know, yeah, you have my respect. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. But, yeah, especially, yeah, domestic violence situations are very difficult because sometimes, you know, they want – the victim or survivor at the time wants it to stop. She doesn't necessarily want him to be taken out of the home, so she can sometimes become upset with the police officers as well. So it's always a precarious situation.
Yeah.
Always.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's
yeah, definitely.
Right. Mm-hmm. So today you're doing very well. You absolutely are, because I'm looking at your bio here. And, you've been married how long now?
Oh, gosh. I was married for 13 years. Since I last spoke to you all, my husband passed away.
Oh,
he passed. Yeah, thank you. He died in December of last year from a massive stroke.
Oh.
Yeah. So he actually died 6 months after my mom did. So 2020 wasn't the greatest of times. And actually, I don't know what it is about me, but I wrote another book.
That's all right. That's good.
I know. I wrote another book from that because I learned something else about me in terms of how my past traumas had taught me to be. And you guys know, I don't know if you know or not, but my maiden name is Strong. So when I say Teresa Strong Myrick, it's not just an adjective I threw in there.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've learned about me, and I knew anyway, is that I had always aspired to be strong. And strong to me really meant that I handled everything on my own. I didn't show any emotions. I didn't ask for anything. I just handled everything on my – I was just a solo person, and everyone thought I had everything handled, so no one ever asked me if I needed help. And I just have lived my life like that without much support and feeling alone and feeling as if I had to do things that way because I couldn't rely on other people. And the only two people that I relied on was my mom and my husband. And when they were not there, I found myself in a place where I had to ask people for things, and it was so terribly uncomfortable for me.
Mm-hmm.
Terribly uncomfortable for me because that had been my protection for years. It's just being strong. And if I had to ask for help, that meant that I was being weak.
Right.
If I cried, that meant I was being weak. If
right.
I screamed in anger, that was weakness. So
did someone tell
just,
you that, though? Let me ask you something. Teresa, you just said something. You just clicked something in my brain. I wasn't allowed
mm-hmm.
to cry. And
no.
If I cried about something, I was put outside. It didn't matter if it was 2 degrees out. That's just the way it was. I had to not feel. So what you're talking
yeah.
about, I don't believe this was your case, but were you like treated that way, or is this something you came upon yourself? Like if someone sees me crying, you know, they'll think I'm weak or whatever.
Well, that's the message I got in some way from growing up. Part of it was that whole saying that I think we all have heard this, is stop crying before I give you something to cry about.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That old saying, we all know that.
Yeah, right? The whole suck it up. What you crying for? It's not that serious. So, then for me, women couldn't be too loud. Nobody likes a loud woman. So I couldn't speak loudly. I had to speak so I could be heard, so I couldn't speak too softly.
Oh, boy. Mm-mm.
Yeah. And then because of my trauma in terms of no one believing me, I didn't feel that my word was worthy anyway.
Yeah.
I had all of these things going on. And to tell anything, especially about the family, what was going on, couldn't do that either. So I just adopted this attitude of pleasing everyone else and doing whatever was required of me, which was being quiet, acting like everything was fine. I did that for years, and that just became who I was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, see, I used to be a people pleaser, too, but no more. No.
Yeah, no more.
And that's kind of a condition, you know. When you're a people pleaser because you're looking so for that acceptance from people.
Validation.
Goes way back, yes, from people who didn't accept us. That's right. That's right. Now I don't care.
Yeah, so.
I don't even care if people don't like me. How's that? Just
yeah,
so long as
I
like
you.
Me, that's what's important. All right?
Yeah. And it's such
That's
a beautiful
true.
Place to be there, right?
No, absolutely. It took me a long time to do that, though.
So 2020 just showed me how I was still acting out of my hurt, acting out of my defense mechanisms, and I had to shake that. I had to shake that and rediscover and redefine what it was for me to be strong. And out of that, a whole book was born. And that one is called Unstrong, 6 Ways to Build Your Self-Love Muscle. Yeah.
You have a good sense of humor. I like that. You know, humor, laughing is good for the soul. It really is. And it just blows out of you. That's good. Absolutely.
Yeah. I do laugh a lot because I didn't laugh before. I talk now because I didn't talk before. I'm just a whole different person. I am the person I was intended to be right now. I am that person now. But I suppressed it for so, so many years that I didn't know this Teresa was in me. I didn't know this version of me. So. So I don't hide a laugh. I don't hide a cry. I don't do any of that anymore. Whatever needs to be felt is just going to be felt. And I'm good with it.
I
feel
know
no
what you're
strange.
Talking about. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel no shame, no blame. And like you said, you either take me or you leave me. That's not my issue. It's not even my problem or my concern right now.
Well, you know, it's a much better place to be at, okay? Let's put it that way. Because before, so often people they get stuck. They get in ruts. They can't look forward. They don't know what forward is. They can't do goals, you know, making goal plans, and they can't do that. Or they'll make it too high, and then they crash, and they have to start all over again. They're worried about whether people like them or not, and actually suffer if they feel let go because people don't like them. And, you learn as you go along on the healing journey that it all starts way back to yourself. All right, things happened.
Mm-hmm.
We were victims at one time. We're still standing, so we're survivors.
Right.
And then we have to start to learn to accept ourselves, to love ourselves, to know that we're good people. We can be good people. We are people of worth. We do have a lot to offer. All these things that are part of the healing journey. And you were able to do that with really not much coaching, if you will, you know, from anyone. I mean, you had this inner strength, and that's good.
I had an inner strength that was definitely innate. I did have an inner strength, but I did have to have counseling and coaching to help me pull things out, to understand. Because what happened was I did go to counseling for a while. I was in and out, but I never, like, felt like I was dealing with it like I needed to. Like, I still had the feelings and the emotions attached to those incidents. And the reason I became a neurotransformational life coach is because I experienced it, and it helped me to get past that part. Right, because, you know, you can get to a certain level and it's like, yeah, I still don't feel as if I'm doing all that I could be doing. I still have some reservation. I still have some resistance. There has to be more. And that was the thing. That was the type of coaching that helped me to get to that next level. Like, it's going to be different for everyone. Everyone's going to have that thing, but you can't stop. You can't give up. You can't, you know, it's just like a doctor. You know, this doctor didn't work. You might need to get a second opinion or try another doctor. But I had to continue to go on, you know, with self-help books, with coaching, counseling, the church, just different things. And all of that, I mean, me working on me consistently helped me to get to this point. So it wasn't just, you know, I evolved here. I had to be prod and questioned and, you know, all of that to get to this, to pull it out of me, to pull me out of me.
Well, it is a process. It's a process.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of process, it's pointing right to me. It says here, life recovery process and neurotransformational coaching. Maybe you can tell the people what that means exactly in your words, what the transformational, that, of course, that means change, but maybe you can, you know, speak a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I talk a lot about these two because I got to a point in my life, probably in my late 30s, where I just felt like I had, you know, you can get to a certain point and kind of go backwards. You take two steps forward and five backwards. And I had gotten to a point where I think I had been married for a few years. I'd had another child, and I had once again put everything else above me, and I wasn't taking care of myself. So I had to dive back in to say, listen, we got to get something going, because I didn't have any goals set. I was just allowing life to happen to me, so I wasn't making any forward progress. And I visited this church, and they had a number of groups that met during the week, and one of them was called Life Recovery. Now, it was, I don't know, I read the description. I'm like, that sounds like something I need, because they were talking about hurts, habits, and hang-ups from your past. And I was like, what, the church is talking about that? And they're going to make it, okay, let me go here. So what it was the 12 steps of recovery, just like in AA, but it was just all biblically based, which it is anyway. But it was more of us understanding more than just chemical addictions. It was us understanding behavioral addictions and things that we were doing habitually that were causing us issues in our lives, and how it stemmed back from our past. But what it was for me is it allowed me to have issues and be a Christian, because before then I didn't think that you could do both of those at the same time. I thought you had to be perfect. I thought you had to be perfect in order to be a Christian. I really believed that.
Oh, jeez.
So that allowed me in my brokenness to still serve God without guilt. So that was the first breakthrough for me.
Right.
And I know many people. I know many people who relate to that, who really feel that they won't go to the church because they're not good enough. Right? So that was a big deal.
But you know what? Then you have those people that go to the church that are phony balonies, too. See, I had to learn that also.
That, too.
Yeah. You know, they're more worried about who's wearing what. You know what I'm saying? They're not really sitting there listening to, you know, to what the priest or the minister or whomever, you know, is saying.
Right.
They're more thinking about,
or,
you know,
yeah.
Oh, my God. I've seen that also.
That.
We have to go to church for
really.
The right thing. You have to go to church
exactly.
for the right reason.
And then,
yeah.
And then because no one was really talking about their problems outwardly, I know for me, that was, this was my experience, I thought that all of the ladies sitting in the church had all their stuff together. Everything was perfect. They were good. And I thought I wasn't doing church right. I'm like, I'm not even doing this Christianity thing right because they got saved and they're not having any more problems. I got saved and I'm still having issues.
Well, look at you today, though. Today you're shining, okay? Today you're shining.
Right.
And
right.
So
exactly.
Something worked, honey, okay? Something worked because you're shining today.
Yes,
yes, you are. That's
yes.
right.
That's what life recovery did for me. It helped me to understand that, oh, okay, we're all broken up in here. They just don't want to show it. I'm good with mine. So that was the first thing. Neurotransformational life coaching is something that gave me, that went deeper than the superficial. So it gave me like a neurological change in how I was experiencing my past so that it no longer had the emotional weight that it was having before. And that was tremendous for me. That was tremendous.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, you went through a process in your healing journey to get to where you are today because you've mentioned
yes, absolutely.
Quite a few different things. Absolutely. And
mm-hmm.
that's what we have to do. You know, you don't just heal overnight. People have to understand that.
No.
But
mm-mm.
they also have to learn to reach out. You know, like when you're in your healing journey, if you get stuck,
yeah.
I get calls on the night owl. So I get calls at 2, 3, sometimes 4 o'clock in the morning. And
mm-hmm.
I used to work night shift and all that stuff. And, you know, flu shift.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't bother me any. But sometimes, you know, people get to a certain point in their healing and then all of a sudden, you know, they don't know what to do with themselves. You know
mm-hmm.
what I'm saying? And that's
yeah.
when, you know, they should go to the contact list and talk to Night Owl. I'll tell them what to do with themselves. You know, they need to start
yeah.
making goals and not being afraid,
right.
you know, to put that one foot in front of the other. And if you fail,
right.
okay. then the goal might be too big. So then you look backwards a little bit, or you look somewhere else. We have the programs
yeah.
on our show that we give people. You know, we offer that on our website, the programs. And with the
mm-hmm.
life, what you were speaking about before, you know, it's like the programs where people can mingle, they can talk, they can reach out to each other, and you can learn from
right.
people, the ones that are not phony balonies, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
and all this other stuff. And so you have to take a lot of different steps, you know, on
mm-hmm.
your healing journey. You know.
Right. You have to be diligent about it. You have to be purposeful, intentful
mm-hmm.
in getting your healing. Because,
yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
we have years of this stuff. And it's not going to disappear in one coaching session, one counseling session. A lot of times when I start with my clients, I tell them, you'll get as much from this as you put in, but you got to be all in on this. And you have to know we're unpacking 30, 40 years of stuff. It's not just going to just disappear in these 3 months. It may take some time, and it takes a while for you to recognize that, you know, you've had some movement, some change, and I work a lot with people. I work a lot with people on setting goals and being in alignment, because we will sometimes, as survivors, we will set our goals from a place of hurt. And we don't even believe the goals that we are setting. We don't believe in ourselves enough to achieve those goals. So some work has to be done before you can even start to make the movement. You know, that's why I believe people don't attain the goals that they set, because they're not emotionally connected to it, because they can't be. They can't be. Their
that's
past
right.
won't even allow them to.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good point. That's a very good
mm-hmm.
point. Because then with you saying that, that gives people ideas of then how to, you know, make goals that are, you know, more acceptable to that they can reach. Because
mm-hmm.
more attainable, you know, they're more accessible. So Yeah, no, that's a good point. I like that. I like that. Mm-hmm. I'll remember that at 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. Well, now you have to set a goal that you can work with, something you can work with.
Right. You know? That's in alignment with who you are, because I can say all day that that I want to lose 20 pounds, but I have to have some kind of attachment to what is it about those 20 pounds that's going to change my life? Is it going to allow me to move around better? Is it going to allow me to breathe better? What is it going to do for me? Because just the 20 pounds, that's not enough. I need to have some kind of emotional connection to the result and what it's going to actually bring into my life.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
Right. I like that because, and that's a good way. It's just like when parents are, telling their children, you did this, you did that, and I don't like it. And then they don't tell them why. Okay.
Right.
And kids are not stupid, and they're going to commit the same thing over and over again because they don't know why they should or they shouldn't do it. And when it comes to goal planning, if you don't have that type of mentality, like you were just speaking about, about the goals that you're making, then you're going to continue to set maybe goals that are not good for you, that they're not attainable. You can't reach them. And
You're not committed to the work.
Yeah.
And you're not committed to the work that requires it.
Right.
Right.
They want the magic pill. Give me the magic pill and make it all go away,
Right, exactly. And it doesn't take everything comes with work. Everything. All the results will come with work.
That's right. Now, Bill, you've been quiet for a very long time. What are you doing? I want to know.
I'm working on the front page of the website, to be honest. But I'm listening.
Oh, okay.
And following along.
That's a good thing to do.
Yeah. I do this a lot, Teresa, just so you know, on Friday nights because I have to prepare the website for the weekend and next week. But I always come on with Carol then, and I can add a tidbit here and a tidbit there. But I was listening. I think like Carol said, you've got your head on your shoulders now. You're thinking squarely. Sounds great. All the stuff you're talking about. So I'm
Thank
very
you.
Happy I had you back. Got you
awesome.
Back.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well,
awesome.
You know, Bill,
that's good.
What she's talking about. Many times I tell people they have to learn to set goals, but I wasn't thinking it through as much as she explained it. And what she said is very important. And, we all have to have goals. And then if we don't, we fall flat on our face. And if we don't have the right goals, we fall flat on our face. And that can turn into depression. That turns into depression.
Oh, absolutely.
And,
because we think we're doing it wrong. Like everybody else is crushing their goals, why aren't I doing the same? What's wrong with me? And it's not anything wrong with us. It's just the goals that we're setting. Are they in alignment with what we believe about ourselves? We either have to change the belief or change the goal.
That's right.
I think we also are better off if we set smaller goals than we're not trying to fix our whole life. In other words. But we are trying to improve something, this or that, the other thing. These are reasonable goals so that when we achieve or start to achieve them, we start to feel better. And what happens with goals, any kind of goal, is when you get it, it's like not the big deal that it was going to be. There's another goal, in other words, down the road that now has taken its place. And that's very common for us and for alcoholics too. It's very, very, very common. But that's a good point, though.
Yeah, it is very good. Yeah.
Yeah. I believe in having big, bodacious dreams and having goals and action steps to get you there. I just believe that you always have to be in action towards the smaller goals that get you to the big, bodacious dreams. You just can't go to the big, bodacious dream right away. There are steps to it. And whenever I'm talking to people, my clients, I always have them start with, okay, what is your level of satisfaction with this area, right? And if it's between 1 and 10, if it's a 2, how do we get from a 2 to a 3? How do we get to a 3 to a 4? Instead of trying to go from 2 to 10, we break it down and just take it just one increment at a time, as you said, just a little bit at a time.
Because I wanted to put this thought out because there's a lot of people that they give themselves unreasonable goals. And, you know, if you give yourself an unreasonable goal, you won't achieve it. But if you give yourself reasonable goals, you will achieve some of them. And when I achieve a goal, when I get to a goal and I'm passing through it, there's another goal already in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not complete because that's how life works. There's goals and then there's goals and then there's more goals and then there's goals, you know.
Right.
I'm not going to be finished till I go. You know, I know I won't finish, you know, but I know I'll have plenty to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. But when you set those attainable goals, that's how you build the momentum to keep going. That's how you build that momentum to keep going, and you celebrate your wins and you enjoy the process.
Right.
With the book that you wrote, tell us a little bit about this book. Okay, and I think you said you'd written another book. You did.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Okay. So it's called Unstrong, and it's 6 ways to build your self-love muscle. Friend, leave your cape at the door. It is really challenging us to take off the superwoman, Superman cape, get real with ourselves and where we are, and just be. Actually, Strong has is an acronym, and it's spelled out throughout the book, and it just is showing us how we can build our inner strength instead of trying to live up to the definition of strong that society gives us, as I was doing, right? So, and I'll tell you real quick, like the un is for uncaping. It's for self-assessment, just giving an assessment for where you are and how satisfied you are with your life. T is for truth and transparency. R is for resilience. O is own your ish. N is your network. And G is the goal setting part. So getting in action.
Yeah.
All right, that's good. I like that. Oh, where'd she go?
I don't know, she disappeared.
I know.
She said, that's all I have to say about that, and hung up.
let's see if she calls back in. I don't know, that was strange.
I think she will.
Yeah, sometimes people hit the wrong buttons on their phone, and here she is. Yeah,
right.
That's funny. I do that. I've done that before. Hold on.
Uh-oh, sorry about that.
That's all right. You do it. I do it at times. Sometimes I'll hit the wrong thing on the phone and oops. Okay. Yeah. But that sounds good because, you see, people need direction. This is why I'm asking you. People need direction in life because they're so – they have no direction at all when they're first starting out to get on to their healing journey.
Right.
They have been down so much or they dislike themselves so much, whatever the case might be, that they don't know how to start, you know, to even get onto the healing journey. And that's a very, very bad spot to be in because you're so filled with anger, rage, fear. Fear is a big fear factor. Fear factor is right. All kinds of things. Yeah. And not having the fortitude even at that point to be able to look forward and say, gee, someday I'm going to be this. And you know what? If you work hard enough and if it's meant to be, you can be what you want to be, okay? You're certainly going to be better. You know, you're going to be better. So often people are just in such a bad state of mind that they're suicidal. Sometimes in the AM, I deal with people who are suicidal. And when you get to know me, I really have a tremendous sense of humor, like you do. You like to laugh, I like to laugh. And by the time I get off the phone with them, they're laughing, their heads off.
Right.
Okay. Now that doesn't mean it's going to stay, though. You see, you have to get the tools to work with. You can make them laugh and lift their spirits and all this other stuff, but they have to have something to work with so that when they get down low, they can pull themselves back up. And sometimes, now you know, with therapists, you can't call them. We can call and leave a message, you know, at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. But you need someone, you know, to actually talk to or have those books that I was talking about, you know, the self-help books that might cover, you know, what you're dealing with. So the healing process is long. It can be hard.
Mm-hmm.
You can go backwards instead of going forwards, and then you can go forwards and stay there for a while, but then not go any further. And, you know, it's kind of, it can be very annoying at times. I've done that in my own healing journey. And and I say, is this it? You know, is this it? I want more.
Yeah.
I don't know what I want more of, but I want more. All right, you know. So, and, you know, that's, you know, places that people get to be also. Now, you've got your head together. You're
yeah,
very
she does.
Smart, and you've got, and she's very smart. And I think I saw a picture of her. She's very pretty. And you know, you've got your act together. And you didn't have, you required some help. Well, it's true. I don't say anything unless it's true. That's just the way it is.
Right.
And so, I mean, you've gotten yourself together to the point in your life where you're comfortable with yourself. And as Bill says, and that's also written, comfortable in your own skin. And, you know, you have joy in you. So often people who are, you know, survivors, they can't find that joy. I walk around the house all the time singing to myself. And I don't know if my neighbors hear me or not. In the wintertime, they probably don't hear me. But in the summertime, I have my windows open, you know, unless I have the air on.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm singing around all over the place, all over the house, and I'm having myself a good old time. I do this. And I think it was last night or the night before, whatever. There was one person heard me, and they said, "Go for it, Carol, go." that made me feel good. But, you know, we have to find things in our lives that make us feel good, you know, whether it be an accomplishment, whether it be singing a song or just being silly, you know, because so often for so long we've been so sad, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We've been so sad. And so if we can find ways to bring ourselves up out of that sadness and into joyfulness and thankfulness.
Exactly.
You know, then that's a goal there. That's one of the biggest goals, to be, you know, satisfied with yourself. And all the things that we worried about, haven't you found this to be true? All the things that when you're a little bit younger, I'm the oldest one here, and that's fine. But that also means I'm the smartest. That's for Bill. But anyway, I tease him all the time. But anyway, the point is, what seems so, you know, detrimental, so horrifying, so awful when we were younger, are so important, and we put too much importance on it. Does this one like me?
Yeah.
Does that one like me? I'm just using that as an example. It can be anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then to be where we're at today, where our minds are much more clear, well, we know what we want from life, and we're able to help people. And that is all very, very, very satisfying, and that's a good place to be. It truly is.
It is. And I think we get to a place, too, where we realize that everything that happened before us was needed for us to be right where we are right now. Like, we needed all those experiences for right now. And I just think it's important that we acknowledge and appreciate all parts of us. Because without, you know, my trauma story, I wouldn't be able to help the women that I help right now, you know, in the way that I can. because not everyone can relate to these stories. Not everyone can have the same compassion for the things that we've gone through and that we live through that still comes up now. Because, you know, I still have moments, like we all do, where I find myself in a funk. And like you said, it's important to have tools to know what's going to bring you out. And I'm like you. I will turn on some music and dance around the house and sing all my old school 80s and 90s and increase my joy factor. I'll dance because I like to dance. But we have to do something or know what it is that can bring us up out of that, even for just a moment, so that we can reclaim some of our joy, because it does get tough sometimes, even with all the healing things I've done. There's still moments, but we just have to be able to tap into ourselves and know ourselves so well that we know what we can do to come up out of it and not stay there.
Yes, that's wonderful. That's good. That's so true. So true. And people don't realize that. But, you know, look, when I have my down moments too. I mean, it does happen.
Yeah.
And I will. This may sound weird to you, but it works for me. All right. So I will feel. I don't feel like singing because I'm feeling maybe too sad or something. But
yeah.
I will make myself sing, and before you know it, I'm singing away. You know?
Right. Exactly.
And I'll go over to Alexa and I say, Alexa, play the Eagles. You know, or whatever. You know. And that's a little before you come. I think it was in the 70s, but whatever. The point is, you know, play the Eagles. I love a lot of their – do Journey. I love Journey, you know, and,
right.
and some of the others, you know, and songs will come forth. And it puts me in a much, much better frame of mind. And I'm actually
right.
feeling good. And then I might go out and get an ice cream cone.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm just saying,
too, I want to also say this, too. There's sometimes, too, when I just need a good cry. I just need
yeah.
a good cry. So sometimes I will turn on a movie that I know that I'm going to cry on and just cry my eyeballs out and get that emotional release from just crying, too, because sometimes I need that. And sometimes I need something outside of myself to cry about just to get the tears out.
But that's cleansing. That's cleansing.
Yeah,
it's
very cleansing. Yeah, it is. It is. I don't want people to think that they can't feel.
I haven't reached that point yet. I haven't reached that point.
Yeah.
I know that there's some times where I should be crying, and I think I was such a stone, or such a, I don't know, statue-like. I became so hardened, so tough. And so rough that I didn't know how to cry anymore. And a person could stand there. I'm just using this as an example. It didn't happen, but I'm just saying. A person could stand there and slap me hard in the face or spit in my face or something like that, spit in my face. And I'd just stand there and look at them. Oh, really? And then I'd probably punch him. Yeah, that, if someone spit in my face, I'd probably do that. But, you know...
Right.
I probably, you know, I have a problem with actually releasing those tears. It'll get, like, stuck in my throat. That's painful at times, you know. It can be sore. And I can't get past the point where those teardrops will only, you know, will come out. When my mother passed away, I cried once. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Because she didn't like me and she told me, and that was the way it was. When my stepfather passed away, I cried once when Marty passed away, my second husband, I cried once. Now, I didn't cry because with my mother and stepfather, because I was going to miss them so. I cried because of what could have been, should have been, and wasn't. The one good cry, okay? If I have to put an animal down, oh, my God. They send me out the back door. happened because I loved my collie, so I had a beautiful collie that was terribly abused, and someone gave it to me, and I took good care of that collie. Marty and I both did. And when I had to put her down, I got her when she was 10 already, and she lived to be 17. So it was time. Yeah, it was time. And everyone thought she was, you know, the real Lassie. They, the kids in the neighborhood. That was so cool. They thought she was the real Lassie. And so I loved that dog. And when we had to put her down, I just, I bawled so hard. The one of the doctors there took me out the back door because he didn't want the patients to see me like that. And the people out there, not the patients. The animals were the patients. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
You know. But, like, then I can cry, you know. I put a couple cats down over the last few years. That was horrifying to me. See, animals are innocent. 99% of the time. Right? You know. And they don't mean to hurt you or whatever unless they're, you know, a crazed animal of some sort.
Right.
Or an animal that was terribly abused. Then you can, you have to watch out for those animals. You do. But generally speaking, you know, I love animals, and I'm still back. I still stand back from people. I don't trust people. And and if someone were to, you know, like slug me in the head or something, which would make most people cry, I probably wouldn't cry. I'd probably just stand there and look at them or find a rock or something to hit them back. You know, that's just the way I am.
Yeah.
So I had that rough exterior that won't allow for me. I may feel, but I can't get the tears out.
Right, and that's okay, right? And that's okay. If there are no tears to come out, then there are no tears to come out. I just don't want people to, like, judge themselves because of however they feel or mourn or feel whatever they're feeling. Because, you know, sometimes we get into the, I should be feeling this, or people tell you how you should feel about certain things. And someone may, you should be crying because your mom passed, you know? And maybe that's not your reaction to it. But whatever we just have to be free to do whatever it is to get through that emotion. Long as we're not holding the emotion in, you know?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. You know, if people treat you poorly, it's just like with a dog. If you keep kicking a dog and stuff like that, the dog isn't going to love you.
Right.
The dog's going to fear you, right? And he's not going to love you and all this other stuff. The same thing with the past that many of us have come from, okay? When my mother became very ill, it was all mechanical. I took care of her. I certainly helped, you know, take care of her a lot. And my stepfather, the same thing. And but the grief wasn't there that maybe other people who had very good, you know, lives with these people. Not everyone's meant to be a parent.
All right.
It's just the way it is. And so, you know, I don't feel guilt towards that. And, you know, that right before my mother passed away, she wasn't really able to speak, but she looked at me and she said, "Carol, I love you." I felt nothing. I needed to hear that when I was a kid. Okay.
Right.
So there's some things that people don't understand when they call me like at 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, and they feel guilt. They have feelings of guilt because they didn't respond, okay? Just like what you said a few minutes ago. They didn't respond the way that maybe society thinks they should respond. No. We all have our own lives. We all have our own backgrounds. And we all have our feelings. And a lot of times they're justified, whatever it might be.
Yeah, because sometimes you just may feel relieved that person is not there. You know, and people will judge that and say that's wrong and that's bad. But if you don't know a person's story, you can't tell them how to feel.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah, you can't tell them. Yeah.
And many times I've, especially with men, I've had men call me, and I tell them to go to the groups, you know. Listen to NASCA, but go to the groups too. And I've gotten a lot of good feedback from that too. And but not to feel guilty, because if someone treats you well, all right, then you're going to treat mm-hmm. them well, and you're going to have the fuzzy feelings that you're supposed to have, you know, or
mm-hmm.
you're going to have, not supposed to, going to have, right?
Yeah.
I just caught myself, mm-hmm. you're supposed to, right? No, 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 you're going to have those fuzzy feelings, you know, and but if they don't treat you well, then you're not going to have those fuzzy feelings, and that's okay.
Right, yeah, you may not.
Mm-hmm.
And even
right.
if you have fuzzy feelings over somebody who treated you bad, it's okay. There's nothing
that's
wrong
right.
with how you feel about it, yeah.
Geez, here's another call. Is it kind of late? Mm-hmm. Hold on a second. Another call,
okay.
Hold on. Who am I speaking to? This is Carol Levine, South Child Abuse Now Show.
This is the Brat. You remember who I am?
Oh, you're Joe the Brat.
Yeah, that's me.
Yeah, I remember you.
I'm sorry to
be late here. Well, how long have you been holding for? I wasn't looking at that part of the studio.
Oh, only about a maybe about a minute or so. I'm not going to interrupt
okay.
the show for too long because I know you have a guest. I just wanted to let you know, I did find that other show that I was telling you about that deals with child abuse. I told them about you, and I told them that you're on just about every day of the week, and for them to get a hold of you, and they said it sounded like a good idea. So so be expecting, hopefully anyway, a phone call
okay.
From the owner of that particular show. It's a different organization than yours, very similar. You know, of course, the mission is for helping survivors of child abuse. And sexual child abuse in particular. So I just wanted to let you know before I forgot. And I will now make my departure so that you get back to your show.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much
sure.
for that. I really, really appreciate that. And you can come on anytime you want. You know that too. So.
Well, yeah, you like brats. I know.
Yeah, I do. I do like brats. Yeah, I do. That's true. I'm a brat too,
okay.
so I understand you.
Yeah, right?
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
Carol, have
Thank
a good
you
weekend.
So much for that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Take care, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Okay, very good. Bye-bye. He's funny. I like that. Yeah. So, but anyway, yeah. If you want people to treat you nice, then you'd be nice. I think that's something we should all think about. You know.
Right.
You know, again, I don't care that much if people are in my fan club or whatever. But
mm-hmm.
on the other hand, there is a certain, I'm not going to say protocol. That's not right. That's not how I want to word that. But I think it just makes common sense, okay, that
mm-hmm.
If we treat people nicely, then we should be treated nicely in return. Yes, absolutely.
Right.
And I think you're a very
yeah.
good guest, and I'm glad you came on.
Oh, well, thank you. I enjoy this. I really do. I
yeah,
enjoy
and, you know,
this.
Well, you opened up my eyes to a few things so that now when they call in the AM about the goal planning, because I always just, to me, I just know it so well. I just say goal planning, but I didn't put any thought before the goal planning.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have the baby steps first. And,
right.
and then also, too, you know, not expect something, you know, too huge, otherwise, you will fall flat on your face.
And I caution about saying too huge because I believe that we can't fully know what I don't want us to get away from, like, if God gives you this idea and you feel it's too big that you say, oh, no, I'm not going to try to do that. But at the same time, we have to make sure that we're doing things step by step, little things at a time, instead of trying to take on the behemoth of the idea right away. So I don't want us to shy away from those big ideas that God may give us because, you know, who knew we were going to have computers and phones that we can talk on and see people on. So, you know, so I don't want us to
shy away from that. I agree with you. That's true. But let me tell you something. Honey, if it wasn't for God, I'd be dead. It's as simple as that.
Right.
Absolutely. And
Absolutely.
He's, you know, I never blamed him for any of the stuff that happened to me because, like I said
right.
last time, you know, God doesn't make junk. People turn into
Mm-mm.
junk. That's what
that's
we
not.
Do. And
mm-hmm.
I've been saying that lately because that's the truth. so many times. I get tired of people saying, well, if God was alive, how come this, how come that, why this, why that, blah, 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 blah. And it goes on and on and on. Look,
yeah,
you know, we can make right choices in life. Everything's about choices, okay? Once we mm-hmm. realize, you know, we get on the healing journey and so forth, and we realize, you know, that this is for our purpose, that we're on the healing journey, and then also, too, we can help other people. Okay, this is about choices.
Right.
And we're either going to make good choices or we'll make bad choices, you know. And, you know, we have to take responsibility for what we can. What happened to us
mm-hmm.
when we were a kid was not our fault, ever, ever.
No,
I don't care
no.
what the situation was, all right?
Right.
And I get some
right.
wild
but neither can
on
you
that.
Change it. But neither can you change it. So... We
no.
have to take a different approach about, because we can't change the people, we can't change what happened. We have to get on the mission of what can we do with ourselves now? How can we make ourselves better for this world? What can we do so that we're not contributing negative things to the world on top of everything that happened to us? How are we going to do better?
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's well put, very well said. Should we bug Bill? He's got to say goodnight to you.
I'm listening.
Oh, okay.
Bill's over there working. He's over there working. You leave him alone. He's over there working.
Are you working? I don't know. But
I thought it was cute that Joe called in and talked about being a brat, and you at least admitted that you are.
Oh, I am a brat.
Uh-oh.
I wouldn't have been
you
able
are.
To survive for 12 years here if I wasn't a brat.
Well,
gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Well, he sounded. I hope he calls in again. I didn't know him. I hope he does.
No, he will. He
but anyway.
When he gets around to it, he will call in. And no,
oh.
I like him. I don't know him really, but I like him because we have the same sort of like personality. You know, we're both brats, and we know it. But we're good brats. We're good brats, okay?
Right.
We do
brats.
Good things.
Of course, of
so,
course.
That's a good thing.
But it's
oh,
it, like the having the good witch. The good witch from the West, you know?
I'm the good witch. Okay, yeah, there you go. Oh, my God.
Oh,
my God.
Oh,
my God. Yeah, I'm definitely the good witch. I am in the West, by the way, so, well, the West of New Jersey anyway, whatever. He's the one that's in the West. Look where you are, for God's sake. But what's the temperature there right now, just out of curiosity?
I don't know. It's too dark to take the temperature.
It's too what?
Dark.
It's too dark.
Oh, okay. I couldn't hear him right. My phone's getting ready to die. Yeah, well,
The weather is dark, let's put it that way.
He doesn't miss this part. You know, he used to live in New Jersey. Yes, he did.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. Where do you live now?
And Florida. She's in Florida.
Oh, and Florida. Okay.
But he lived in New Jersey. I think it was in Mountain Lakes. Isn't that what you said some time ago?
That's correct. That's correct.
Yes. And I didn't live that far from him. Oh, my God. I didn't know him then. But, it's cold here. Yeah, it is. Last night it was like 20. The night before that was 17. Then it got down to 9. Are you kidding me? And I had to take the garbage out.
It's like that here. We had T-shirt weather for part of the day today. You know, the sun came out, it was bright, and it was warm. But
mm-hmm.
right now I would say it's a little chilly, but not much.
No.
So,
yeah, I think our high was 67 today.
Oh, wow.
Which is chilly for us.
Yeah.
That's my kind of weather. I like it between 67 and 75. I was telling Bill this a long time ago. Like if I went down Florida and it gets up to 104 or something in certain areas, or if I went out to California or Nevada or wherever in those areas there and it's 103, no, I would die. I would die. I'd be dead. That's what would kill me. Not people, not actions. No. It would be the weather. I can't handle it. That's how I feel about extreme cold.
That's exactly how I feel about extreme cold.
Oh, don't want any parts of it.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a friend that moved out to Nevada, and she is delighted. It was 103 not too long ago, like a couple days ago, and she just loves it. And she can run in it. How can you do that? No. I could never do that. No. Ridiculous.
Yeah, I hear you.
But anyway, yeah. But anyway, I'm getting back to the show. I like to scout around a little bit. But Bill knows me. I do this. But it's interesting talking to other people from different parts of the country and so forth. But anyway, thank you so much for coming on again. And like in about 2 minutes, okay, the show's going to be over. What would you like to leave with lasting words to people? What would you like to leave about hope?
Of course, that there is hope, that healing is available to you. It is up to you to make the decision to get on that journey. We all have choices. You can certainly stay where you are, but every day you can make a new decision and expect a different result. But as long as you're doing what you're doing, you're going to continue to get the same thing. I know we hear that all the time, but I want so badly for everyone to feel the joy that I've learned to feel, to cultivate the joy that I've now cultivated. It was a long, hard journey. It was uncomfortable many of times, but it is so, so worth it.
That's right. Amen to that. I would not want to be where I was 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. I'll stop there.
Right.
But anyway, no, I would not want to be, because quite frankly, I was a miserable lady.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we deserve, and this is the thing, that we deserve to be free from that. We deserve to be free. We don't have to live in that bondage. We deserve freedom. We just have to work for it.
That's right.
And be willing.
And it's doable, it's attainable. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And and we can be happy too. And you can be slap happy, like
bless
she can
you,
be
Mom.
Like, you know, like Teresa, she's dancing around the house, and me, I'm singing around the house. So there you go.
Exactly.
And I'm not sure what Bill's doing, but anyways. I don't know what he does for pleasure. I don't know. What do you do? You sing, dance? I don't know.
I take naps.
That's called the
naps are good.
That's called what do you call it? You're going away from it. You're running from it. There you go.
No. I'm just letting go, you know. I'm surrendering.
Yeah, naps are good.
Yeah,
naps can be rejuvenating.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they can be. That's true. I'll take that back. But anyway, yes, I'm waiting for the 90-second cue so I can end the show, and it's coming up very momentarily. But,
awesome.
You know, we need to have people like you on, though, Teresa. Because you have been a police officer, and I do like to get into conversations about that.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're a life coach, and that's great, you know. And you've done quite a few things, and you came a long ways. So I got my 90-second cue, so I'm going to end the show. And you know, in a year, maybe 9 months, whatever, we'll get a hold of you again. We'll talk about your other book. Okay, I think you said you had a second book, correct? Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And get that out there. So anyway, thank you. Good night. God bless. Stay safe. And only do a little about the things that I do. Don't do what I do. That's where the brat comes out.
Thank you, guys.
That's okay. Bye-bye now. Good night.
All right. Good night.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you, too.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, good.